Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare administration and policy at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. I have a musical puzzle for you. Based on this playlist, what healthcare theme are we covering today?
Teach your children well, their father's health did slowly go by.
Our playlist harmonizes the voices of singers who found new life through organ transplants. In order, the artists are Neil Crosby and Greg Allman, who both had liver transplants, and Tina Turner, Natalie Cole, and Billy Preston, who all received new kidneys. Today, we unravel the melodies of life and the transformative impact of organ donation in honor of April being National Donate Life Month. Then, how to unlearn silence in healthcare. Noted corporate mediator Elaine Lynn Herring teaches us how. But first, we invite Dr. Shannon Mao. She's a transplant surgeon at Mayo Clinic in Florida and a general surgery residency director to our program. Dr. Mao, welcome. So good to have you here in studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start off with something that has become a topic in the headlines recently. Surgeons in Boston have transplanted a kidney from a genetically engineered pig into an ailing 62-year-old man, the first procedure of its kind. And if successful, the breakthrough offers hopes to hundreds of thousands of Americans whose kidneys have failed. So far, at least since today that we're talking, the signs are promising. The new kidney did begin to produce urine shortly after the surgery. So given that this has just been in the headlines, I start with that. How big a deal is this headline?
So I think it's an incredibly exciting breakthrough. It could give an opportunity for multiple individuals with kidney disease and potentially other needs of transplant to have opportunities for organs that they didn't have before. I think it still remains to be determined how quickly this will become adapted in the mainstream, but it's a very exciting development for our field.
Are there risks with implanting a genetically engineered organ from another species?
So there are risks. Certainly there are risks with everything that we do. If this technology goes on to become mainstream, there is FDA and other regulations that ensures that it's safe for the individual that would be receiving the organ. And I'm certain, although I wasn't directly involved sure. in this study, I'm certain that they have gone through many levels of protection for their recipient as well.
I imagine the reason that they got to doing this type of procedure is because of just the current state of just finding organs for transplants. So I guess the question is, what is the current state of affairs when it comes to organs?
Absolutely. So despite incredible generosity of individuals who offer their kidneys or livers as living donors, or individuals who've offered their organs at the time of their passing, we still have a far greater need for organs than what we have available. Individuals are dying every day, really every hour, on the waiting list, waiting for a transplant. And so the more we can get the word out to encourage individuals to sign up to be donors, and that's really what Donate Life Month is all about. And also we consider some of these other opportunities as ways to really become better apt to serve all the people that need transplants.
How long are these waiting lists that we're talking about for different organs?
So waiting list does vary based on the organ. The average waiting time for a kidney in our region is somewhere around 5 to 6 years.
Oh, wow.
And that is time that the individual is likely on dialysis receiving support in order to get to that point. For other organs, such as liver, that waiting time really depends on how sick an individual is. So it's rated on a scoring system, and the sicker the individual gets transplanted. But again, it could be years that somebody's waiting for an organ.
So we are definitely not talking in a short run. These are, and you may not even get the organ.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, many people become too sick before they are eligible to receive an organ. And that's where we encourage, particularly on the kidney side, living donation. So somebody offering a kidney on your behalf to help you to get transplanted more quickly and to avoid the amount of time that you spend on dialysis waiting for that life-saving gift.
What organs, just as a general sense for our audience, are transplanted? I know you brought up liver and kidney, but give us the range
sure.
these days.
Absolutely. So from a solid organ perspective, an individual can donate their heart, their lungs, and the lungs may be used together, both lungs to one person, or they may be split to more than one individual. In addition, you have liver, pancreas, and then both kidneys. And the kidneys are typically, again, split, so one kidney to each person. These are the solid organs that are used for transplant. Individuals who've passed can also donate things such as cornea, tissue, bone marrow. Those sorts of things are also considered opportunities to really impact the life of individuals.
Is the only organ that you can donate for while the person that donating is alive, is that pretty much the kidney or?
Kidney and liver. And so liver. You can donate a portion of your liver. The liver actually regenerates. So an individual okay. can donate a portion of the liver, and that liver can actually grow back, both for the individual that's donated as well as the individual receiving the liver. It will grow back to a more normal-sized liver.
There's so much that I imagine in your day-to-day work. You get to see stories that stick with you. And I guess from a personal note, what inspired you to become a transplant surgeon?
Absolutely. So going through my training, both in medical school and then in residency, I really wanted to find a field of medicine that allowed me to have a direct impact on patient care. And there's really nothing stronger than a transplant. When you give someone a new organ, most of my patients tell me, and I do liver, kidney, and pancreas transplant, most of my patients tell me they didn't know how sick they were until after they got a transplant. The morning after the surgery, despite having some pain, they typically feel better than before the surgery. Their color comes back. Family members tell me they have this energy that they didn't have beforehand. And so that's just an incredibly impactful experience as a surgeon to really make that difference. And then on the flip side, I get the opportunity to honor our incredible donors. So I think there's really nothing stronger than being with someone after their passing and really living their legacy out. an incredible tragedy has befallen the donor and their family, and it's really a great honor to be able to share their life with someone else and hopefully to extend someone else's life because of their gift.
What keeps you motivated amongst, I imagine, there are big high highs and some very low lows? How do you keep the motivation going?
I think it's the, for me, it's the smile on the face of that recipient when they're leaving the hospital. It's the patient that before transplant was losing weight, was stuck on a dialysis machine, or was suffering with ascites and complications of liver disease. And they come back to see us in the clinic with a smile on their face and the energy to do what they want to do. It's the Christmas card you get from the patient that says, thank you for another Christmas with my family.
I love hearing that. Just from a logistical standpoint, when you are in these procedures, these are hours and hours. I mean, just give a sense to our listeners what we're talking about.
So a kidney transplant is typically somewhere around 3 hours. Okay. A liver transplant is typically between 4 to 6 hours, can sometimes be longer. We do, in certain circumstances, also do two organ transplants. So the most common being a kidney and pancreas transplant in the setting of diabetes. Also, we sometimes do a liver and kidney combination. Those can be up to 9 to 12 hour long surgeries.
Wow. When someone is finding themselves with a condition that is leading to a circumstance where transplantation is going to be the most likely option, what are the key factors that that person should consider when choosing a transplant center? Is there, I assume there's choice where you go. What should people be asking and thinking about?
I think first and foremost, it's most important to choose the center where you have support. So both where you feel supported by your transplant program, but there are also external factors. So your recovery process is going to be a long process. And so it's wonderful if you can have family or friends that support you in the area that you're going for the transplant. Other factors to think about, there is differences in transplant programs, and there's publicly available information on SRTR, the Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients, SRTR.org, that allows you to look and compare waiting times and outcomes between different programs. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think it's really important to get a good feel for the program. So when you go to be evaluated, that you understand and have a good rapport with the individuals that are part of that team taking care of you, because transplant is lifelong. Once you get a transplant, you're a patient of that transplant center for the rest of your life.
Which, that's a huge commitment. Okay. To all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. If you're just joining us, we're talking about organ transplants, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at Jay Servin. Could you share, without giving breaking any confidentiality, a particularly memorable or touching story of a successful transplant that you've been a part of?
Every transplant story is incredibly memorable and touching. But one that really sticks with me was when I was a fellow, I was part of a transplant of a younger recipient, and they received an organ from a younger donor. And the parents of the donor and the recipient eventually were able to meet. And the two moms had this incredible connection after that transplant, that the two moms were connected by the gift of the donor to the recipient, and seeing those two moms. And they've actually gone on to share their story publicly as well about the connection that they had together. And that story was just incredibly powerful.
Wow. I can only imagine seeing that connection like that. That is amazing. We just talked about earlier when we started our discussion about the genetically engineered pig organ. What other advancements in transplant surgery are you finding either most exciting or promising in this area?
Absolutely. So very exciting, which really made it to mainstream, is our ability to use organs that have hepatitis C for transplantation. So as early as 5 to 7 years ago, hepatitis C was one of the most common reasons that we were transplanting liver. With the advent of new medications, we can, in some cases, prevent and in other cases, cure hepatitis C.
Wow.
So this is really an exciting frontier that's essentially mainstream now, which has dramatically increased the number of organs, is that we actually use hepatitis C positive donors for positive or negative recipients, treat them with medications that cures the virus, and they go on to live a full and exciting life afterwards.
Wow, that's huge, because I still remember when hepatitis C, what you just said.
Right.
That's a striking
development.
So it's
an incredible development. Another area that's really exciting on the field of liver is that we have new perfusion devices, meaning ways to support the liver with a blood-based perfusion. So when the liver comes from the donor to the recipient, we can support the liver in a way that allows us to use even more organs for transplant, use organs from farther distances, and support organs that may have a little bit of a challenge because of how the donor passed away or other medical factors related to the donor to use those organs successfully. And that's dramatically increased our use of livers across the board as well.
Because the line of people waiting for organs is so long, what are the common misconceptions about the process of becoming an organ donor that you hear and you want to dispel right here now?
Sure. I think one thing that I hear very commonly is that people are not interested in being an organ donor at the time of their passing because they think that perhaps they won't receive the same medical care. And that is absolutely not true. So as a transplant provider, I am completely separate from the care team that is taking care of the patient. So once someone has been declared legally deceased, that's when the transplant team gets involved. All the steps leading up to that declaration are done by a completely separate team. You will receive the same care as an organ donor that you would receive as not as an organ donor, and then you can go on to still donate your organs at the time of your passing. Also, on the living donor side of things, I always tell people don't rule yourself out as a living donor. If you have any interest in donating a kidney or a portion of the liver, come forward and allow the medical team to take a look at things. We have some really exciting new advances even in living donation. We've used living donors up to the age of 75 or even older. We are currently just beginning to use living donors that are greater than the age of 65 with type 2 diabetes as well as kidney donors, which is something that we have not been able to previously use.
One of the issues that comes up a lot, and we bring it up on this show often, has to do with health disparities. In fact, when I had an intro of organ transplant playlists, because so many famous artists have received organs,
absolutely.
What thing that struck me is that a big chunk of them were African American. What is the state of affairs of health disparities in the transplant world?
Absolutely. Many of the disparities that pervade healthcare, unfortunately, are pervading transplant as well. So diseases particularly that lead to kidney failure, such as hypertension and diabetes, are more common in the African American and Latino communities. And in addition, there is a reduced rate of living donation among the African American communities as well. And so I think it's really pertinent for us as individuals to help to dispel those myths and to get more people to come forward as organ donors and to ensure that we support all of the members of our community.
You brought this up earlier when you're talking about the way patients are on this list to get the organ. Can we delve a little bit into that? Can you explain the process a little bit of how donors and recipients get matched? And I'll just ask, and is there a way for people who are listening who may be wondering, who are on that list, that maximizes your shot?
Sure. So from a deceased donor perspective, it depends a bit on the organ. I can speak to kidney and liver because those are what I do the most. Liver for deceased donors is allocated primarily based on the sickness and the blood type. So we have something called the MELD score. It's based on laboratory studies and your blood type, and that is how matching occurs. For kidney, it's based primarily on waiting time or time on dialysis. And in addition, living donors are an incredible option. If a living donor is identified, that person donates directly to an individual or on behalf of an individual, and there is no waiting time. So, for example, if you had someone willing to donate a kidney on your behalf, could be a friend, a family member, sometimes a stranger, you are brought to the top of the list to receive that organ. And even if that individual may not be a direct match for you, they could donate to someone else through what we call a kidney paired exchange, and then that individual's donor could donate back to you, or even a chain of individuals. So that could bring several individuals up to the top of the list with one person's gift.
Wow. And if you don't have someone who is, you're lucky enough that they can donate to you for whatever reason, is there any way to maximize the success on the list, or is it just how sick you are?
It's really based on how sick you are or time on the waiting list. But again, we encourage people to really reach out broadly. I've heard of individuals find donors by going to Disney with a T-shirt, having a billboard on their, or a bumper sticker on their car. Individuals have done media appearances and telling and sharing their story, web pages, long lost friends coming out through Facebook. So I really encourage people, and we actually support the sharing of stories through what we call a microsite program with a partner, the National Kidney Registry, where we help people to make a website to share their story.
What do you think is the biggest challenge for you as a transplant surgeon?
100%, it's not having enough organs to help everyone. If I could transplant everyone the minute I meet them in the clinic, that would be my goal and my dream.
If you had to dispel any type of misconception or myths about recovery, post-transplant care, what important tips or advice that people may not know that maybe it's a good to know as you walk into this?
So I always tell people that the healthier you are coming into a transplant, the better. It can be really challenging when you don't feel well, when you're on dialysis or you're struggling with the complications of liver disease or heart or lung disease. It can be really challenging to keep your spirit up and keep motivated. But the healthier you are coming into the transplant, the healthier you're going to be leaving the transplant. And so the more stamina you have, the more, even if it's just a short walk during a television commercial break, the better you're going to be coming out of the transplant. I also encourage people and remind people that we're going to be your cheerleaders and your champions, and don't think you're going to stay in bed a long time after the transplant. Most of my liver patients are walking that night, and the kidney patients the same.
As we think about the future transplant surgery, what are your hopes for the field, or how do you see it developing?
I'm very excited by all the advances we have in organ availability and use of organs. There's also some incredible advances in immunosuppression and opportunities to make organs last longer. So really my hope and my passion is that we can get to a point where we are able to deplete our waiting list. We're always going to find more people in need of transplant, but the earlier and the quicker we can get to individuals and get them feeling better, the better.
I take it, given the amount of folks involved in a transplant team, that this is all insurance covered. Can you comment on just the bill with this?
So transplantation is an expensive enterprise, as you point out. Transplant is covered under insurance plans. Certain insurance plans may have contracts with certain hospitals, but transplant itself is covered under insurances, and we work with multiple insurance providers to ensure that you get the best possible care.
I want to give you the opportunity to address the listeners out there, and I want to ask you, what conclusions should someone who's been listening to our conversation take away from all that we've covered and talked about?
First and foremost, I think many listeners likely have a connection in some way to organ, either transplant as a donor or a recipient, or a family member or a friend of a donor or a recipient. So first and foremost, I want to thank all of our donors and our donor families for the gifts that they've given, and honor all the recipients for the great lives that they're living. I would encourage everyone to, you know, look deep in their hearts. And as we are entering Donate Life Month, if this is something that moves you to sign up as an organ donor or share those wishes with your family, that's an incredible opportunity. If you're interested in more information about being a living donor, again, reach out to a transplant center. People can donate even without an intended recipient, or what we call altruistically. Come forward, say, I'm interested in donating, and potentially start a chain to help multiple individuals suffering with kidney disease. So I thank all the listeners for learning more about organ donation and organ transplantation, and encourage you to take the next step.
Dr. Mao, I just want to thank you, number one, for all that you do and all the people you're helping, and number two, for giving us your time, your very, very busy time today, to talk to us about this huge topic.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Dr. Shannon Mao. She's a transplant surgeon at Mayo Clinic in Florida and the surgical director for kidney transplants and living donations. Up next, after your weekly health headlines, Unlearning Silence. And we'll be right back.
This will be an everlasting love. This will be the one I've waited for. This will be the first time anyone.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and this is What's Health Got to Do with It? These are your weekly health headlines. To start, increasing insurer denials for air ambulance rides. Emergency room doctors report a rise in insurers denying coverage for costly air ambulance rides, citing lack of medical necessity. Now, the No Surprises Act, enacted in 2022, aimed to protect patients from out-of-network bills, but allows insurers to avoid it by deeming care not medically necessary. This loophole favors insurers who controls what this means, often leading to denials despite the air ambulance industry's high costs. Medicare data shows providers win 8 in 10 arbitration cases, driving prices up further. Medicare beneficiaries will benefit from reduced coinsurance rates for 41 Part B drugs following an Inflation Reduction Act policy. Senator Bernie Sanders demands Novo Nordisk lower prices for Ozempic and Wegovy, revealing manufacturing costs far below current prices. Novo Nordisk responds by emphasizing patient resources but doesn't address cost concerns directly. Reinventing CPR by ECMO-based eCPR. A new CPR method called eCPR, using ECMO machines for full life support, show promise in cardiac arrest cases. There's been a human case of bird flu in Texas that raises concerns of pathogen transmission. A person in Texas treated for bird flu, a rare human case, was linked to infected dairy cows. Despite low public risk, experts monitoring for potential human-to-human transmission at this time. The mental health crisis extends to pets, reflecting human struggles. Rising Prozac prescriptions for dogs highlight a broader mental health crisis, mirroring increasing anxiety and depression rates in humans. Cheap generics, mood stabilizers, now commonly used to address pets' behaviors, is occurring amidst a shortage of mental health services. This intersection of health challenges underscores the need for accessible mental health care. And those are your weekly health headlines. Can you name the incredibly popular movies that have this original score? If you named A Quiet Place, I'm impressed. The characters in these movies live in a post-apocalyptic Earth after being attacked by blind extraterrestrials who have an acute sense of sound. The only way to survive is silence. If someone makes a sound, they'll die. Our next guest, metaphorically speaking, argues that in our present-day society, there are incentives for us all to stay silent. This is causing problems that we must unlearn, especially when it comes to healthcare. Elaine Herring is a facilitator, speaker, writer, and a lecturer at Harvard Law School whose focus is dispute resolution, mediation, and negotiation. She's worked with hundreds of companies, ranging from American Express, the Red Cross, Nike, Pixar, and Google. She has an amazing new book called Unlearning Silence: How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully. And she joins us now from Berkeley, California. Elaine, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's so good to have you here. I'm going to start off with the question that I think many of us would have. Why did you write this book? What inspired you to pursue the topic of unlearning silence?
I spent more than a decade teaching soft skills, communication skills in all different places, across industry, across geography, skills for negotiating, having difficult conversations, giving and receiving feedback, all essential skills for collaborating and working together in this environment that we find ourselves in. And yet, despite those tools and frameworks that my colleagues at the Harvard Negotiation created being sound, some people still wouldn't negotiate. Some people still wouldn't have the difficult conversations. Some people still wouldn't give or receive feedback, no matter how much their manager or HR told them they should. So I started to wonder, why is that? And as I looked across clients, looked in my own life, looked at the patterns within organizations, I looked and noticed silence. In what ways have we learned to stay silent? In what ways are we rewarded, particularly professionally, for staying silent? In what ways, despite our best intentions, do we silence the people around us? And so if we really want to negotiate, have difficult conversations, give and receive feedback, coexist, we need to solve for silence.
That is so fascinating. And when you're saying it, I'm seeing at so many heads nodding in agreement in our team here, listening to your response. I'll ask you this. This is a question that I was talking with my wife about this book when she saw it. And I think it's an interesting question. What does silence look like?
Yeah. This is the tricky, invasive thing about silence. Silence is by definition an absence, absence of voice, absence of thought. It is self-censoring so that, you know, the voices in your head tell you that the idea is stupid, so you don't even say it out loud in the meeting at work. It is anticipating someone else's response, even if that's not their real response, and saying, oh, I guess I can't say that to my wife. Right? Because we need to keep the peace, because we just got to a good place and I don't want to rock the boat. Silence is having to edit out parts of yourselves that can be thoughts, feelings, that can also be identities. And it's also when there's not enough room, either in the physical room, the meeting, or in the relationship for your needs, goals, hopes, and priorities. Right? It seems like everyone else's needs, goals, hopes, and priorities has sucked all the energy out of the room.
Yes.
And so the thing I can do is, you know, not be difficult, which means I don't have needs. I'm a needless person, and I am just here to make life easier for everyone else. But what gets lost in that is both a sense of agency, and also we can only exist for so long without our own needs being met.
This is so hard when I because what you're saying is really resonating with me. But how do you unlearn that? I mean, this is And maybe I'll ask it, since this is a medical show, how, in the context of healthcare, how do you unlearn exactly what you just said, the absence of voice, the absence of rocking the boat?
Well, before we go there, if I may, let's talk about why silence is damaging.
Okay.
Right? Having to hide a part of your own identity or watch what you say keeps your nervous systems on chronic high alert. We were not built to always be operating on high alert. And so the levels of stress end up causing digestive issues, heart issues, migraines, chronic fatigue, all this stuff that leads to burnout over time. Silence is also a common trauma response. So we stay silent in order to survive and avoid the negative backlash that we might otherwise need to engage. And certainly not talking about things means that social isolation continues. And the Surgeon General and many others have done extensive research on social isolation being comparable to smoking and obesity in terms of shortening one's lifespan. So really want to highlight that silence is problematic both in our relationships, but also in our very own health. Now, in the healthcare system, and I say this both as a patient and as a consultant observing the system, and as someone who has coached people within the healthcare system, there is such hierarchy and such obtuseness as to what really happens. As a patient, I think, well, I'm not the medical professional. You are the doctor, you're the MD, the OD. And so I should defer to you as it comes to your analysis of my situation. But if we also think about the healthcare system in the United States, I get a 10-minute slot with you.
That's right.
Are you really the expert about my body and my situation, or am I? After all, I spend a whole lot more time with me and my body than you do. And so where does the deference, where does the self-advocacy, where does the, okay, but what about this system? Why does that make sense? Are you really just treating the symptom? Or are you treating the root cause? Is there room for those conversations in a system that allows so little time for patient caregiver interaction?
All of it is so, so true. So walk us through, this whole concept of how you can undo this. How do you start?
I would start by questioning authority, which I know is a radical and controversial thing to say.
Yes.
So I will own that and maybe start from the perspective of a patient. When I went into the hospital to give birth to my son, I started vomiting afterwards, and then I was given anti-nausea medication. And I thought, okay, well, I'm not the medical professional. Let me take the medicine prescribed to me. And then that ended up having me go to the ER a week after, throwing up blood and never causing the root issues. So to me, what I would have done in the moment is to say, why am I vomiting? If you're not solving for the root cause, can I ask those questions? And so often there is pure deference to someone that we perceive as the authority figure, and rightly so, right? Mm-hmm. I have not done that study in medicine. You are a doctor, I am not. And am I thinking rigorously? Are we thinking rigorously about what's going on? Now, it may sound like there's judgment on doctors or nurses here, and it's all part of the gnarly system we find ourselves in.
Right.
If that nurse has 3 minutes and is already overtasked, has too many patients on the slate, that is part of my responsibility to say, to disrupt the system and say, hold on, why are you prescribing this medicine? What else might be going on there? Here's what I know about my body, rather than staying silent and assuming that deference. So step one is remembering that we can ask questions, because efficiency would say, well, they got to get to the next patient. You know, don't take up too much of their time. Don't take up too much space. And we forget that we even have an option. So there is an agency aspect to it to really understand, particularly when it comes to our own health. How does this impact me? Can I get answers to my questions? The second is, do I retain agency over my own healthcare decisions? Just because a medical professional is prescribing it, if I don't understand it, do I go along with it because that's what you do? Or do I take the week to do some more research, get a second opinion? in what ways can I retain agency over my own decision making in my own understanding? And then if we look at a systemic perspective, because silence isn't just the ways that we have internalized or the ways that we might silence each other, but silence is baked into our systems, how do we take a good hard look at our healthcare system to say, in what ways is silence baked into our policies and practices? And the audit around that would be two simple questions that are easy to ask, hard to answer, right? In what ways do our policies, who do our policies support and who do our policies silence?
Right.
And the answers start to unravel where silence might be baked into the system, which may benefit the bottom line, but doesn't necessarily benefit patients or healthcare professionals and the reason they got into this practice in the first place.
Let me ask a question. Again, this is resonating with me, and I suspect with our listeners as well, because everything you're saying is absolutely right. What if someone were to say, but there are certain moments that you don't need to speak? Is that, or does that not exist in this construct? How do you address that, or how do you answer that?
Oh, there are definitely moments where we don't speak. Let me be really clear. This is a little bit of my lawyer background coming through. To avoid any doubt, unlearning silence does not mean saying everything, everywhere, all the time to everyone. The world is too noisy and too complex for that. That's why chapter 3 of the book is When Silence Makes Sense.
Okay.
But the difference between silence that is additive and silence that is negative or oppressive is agency. Do I get to choose when I want to stay silent because I think that's the best course of action, or because I'm playing the long game and or I'm choosing my battles, or is silence the only option for me because it is chosen for me? So that to me is a really key difference of whether I am choosing to stay silent as a matter of my agency or whether I am forced to be silent.
Understood. I hear so many times, it almost seems almost cliche now, people talk about finding their voice. Is unlearning mean the same thing the way you view it? That's what finding your voice is?
Yeah, I would say finding your, let's break down terms again.
Okay.
Voice is not just the words that we use in a conversation or in a meeting. Voice is how we move through the world, where we put energy toward. And part of the question of finding your voice is implicitly we're asking, do I even have a voice? Does it matter what I think or feel? Am I a cog in a wheel, or do I actually have impact? Do I have agency? So to me, finding your voice is figuring out, if we each have one life to live, how do you want to live that life? Are you living the life that you intend to live with the values that you intend to live, or are you going through the motions on autopilot, maybe fulfilling someone else's desires or expectations for you? For me personally, having spent a lot of time solving for everyone else's needs, goals, hopes, and concerns, there is a really disorienting moment when you wake up as what you believe is a grown-up,
right,
and you're thinking, what is my, do I have a voice? How can I be a grown person and not know what my voice is? Who am I, right? And who has time for an existential crisis to figure out who we are? But to me, finding your voice really is answering this question, if we each have one life to live, how do we want to live it? Which, of course, living in alignment with your values is a step toward greater health.
Do you have, I know you shared the personal one with you as a patient in the delivery setting. Do you have another story or example of how unlearning silence really led to a transformative change?
Change fundamentally requires difference. Change requires challenging the status quo, which of course is not always welcome. But a lot of times within the healthcare system where I end up coaching and working is to say, you know, there are residents coming through the system. And this is one of the examples in the book. And there is a well-worn path in terms of doing your residency, getting on the good side of an attending physician,
yes,
that there's such deference built into that relationship. And yet, if we want to continue to improve the quality of our practice and the care that we provide, we inherently need new perspectives. One of the great ironies of being human is that the longer you do something, the more entrenched you are in a system, the less you can see the opportunities for improvement or for continuous learning. And so when I'm working with residents and chief residents and, you know, those who have been in practice a long time, it's how do you open up those flows of feedback? If you're in that operating room, do you want the nurse or the anesthesiologist to actually say something if something's going to go wrong? There should be, from a matter of patient health, the opportunity and the appreciation for someone speaking up. But there's so many dynamics and so many personalities and so much deference to the surgeon, for example, that often those perspectives don't make it out of the person's body, right? Don't make it into the conversation and to really damaging effects for the patient. And I would argue that the work is both for people who have less organizational institutional power. Oftentimes that's nurses, even if they have been in practice and in that role for decades, to speak up and say something. But speaking up isn't just about courage or more confidence. Speaking up fundamentally is about calculation.
You know, your book, Unlearning Silence, it seems to offer this holistic approach to communication and self-expression. And I'm wondering, how do you envision readers of the book that they apply these principles, not only in the healthcare setting, but in their everyday lives? How would you kind of, other than obviously read the book, but what suggestions would you have?
I would ask the question, what silence might I have learned along the way, right? What assumptions do I hold about who gets to speak, who gets to be heard, what is proper? And to take a good hard look at that, because that is all unconscious, subconscious assumptions that drive our behavior. Despite our best intentions, we as human beings end up silencing each other. I can love you, I can claim to love you, I can want to be a great leader to you, and you know, in the book, I discuss 9 different ways that we end up silencing other people, starting from forgetting that speaking up or saying something could actually be difficult for someone because it's not difficult for me, or requiring them to speak to me in the communication medium and mode that is easiest for me to digest, which creates barriers to entry for them to enter the conversation. And of course, looking at how silence is baked into the systems that we're all a part of. So this holistic approach to me is, what ownership can I take over my own silence in the world? What ownership can I take over whether I'm really loving and leading the people around me well? And then together to analyze and tackle the systemic questions. But part of the reason the book is structured holistically is because I, like many people, was given the advice, just speak up.
Yeah, that's
be louder, be more clear. And then I turn the corner and sort of 30 seconds later, someone would say, well, you're too loud.
Yes.
And I think I can't get it right. And you keep changing the target on me. What am I supposed to do? And so to me, it's really not just about speaking up. It's what role does silence play on our teams? What role does silence play in our relationship? What role does silence play in our organization? And being really intellectually honest of, are we trying to create a culture of voice here where people can move freely, don't have to edit, not just the loudest ideas come forward, but the best ideas, that we honor the dignity of every human being? Or are we building a culture of silence where many of us have to tiptoe, feel like we're walking on eggshells, edit out parts of ourselves? what are we building together? What are we building certainly in the healthcare system, but also at home, where so much of the learned silence and those habits and patterns are built, with the invitation to say, what got us here doesn't have to be what brings us forward, right? What I learned in the past, and this is where unlearning comes into play, what I learned in the past doesn't have to determine what happens tomorrow in my own life and certainly on my team and in the world that we are co-creating.
I'm going to let that serve as a last word. Elaine, I want to thank you so much. This is incredible. The book is amazing. And thanks for giving us your time today, because this has just been absolutely wonderful.
Of course. So honored to be with you all.
We've been talking to Elaine Herring. She is an author of the new book, Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Quorum is our director. Next week's program is our monthly Health Roundtable show. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362. Email us at health@wjct.org or tweet me at Jay Servin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.